comes the sun and I say it's all right.
Hello, K-Squid listeners, and Happy New Year. It's every other Sunday again, and you're listening to Sustainability Now, a bi-weekly K-Squid radio show focused on environment, sustainability, and social justice in the Monterey Bay region, California, and the world. We've declared January 2022 to be Solar Energy Month on Sustainability Now. We're bringing to you two shows about solar electricity in order to prepare you for our Sunday, January 23rd show, when we'll be welcoming Dr. Ahmed Farouqi, an energy economist who has been deeply involved in solar electricity issues in California. We'll be talking about the pending decision by the California Public Utilities Commission to impose grid participation charges on households with rooftop solar. The proposal has the solar industry and solar activists up in arms, with many concerned that it will stunt the growth of local solar energy in California. We've assembled a show for today that draws on past episodes focused on solar energy. First, we'll be hearing from Dr. Dustin Mulvaney, a San Jose State University professor and solar energy expert, to talk about private utilities in California. Then, we'll hear Fred Keeley, who has been deeply involved in electricity law and regulation for more than 20 years, to talk about the future of electric utilities in California. In the third segment of the show, Ali Detrio, chief strategist at Reimagine Power in San Francisco, will run us through how solar law and regulation functions in California. Finally, Bob Staton will talk about his solar dividends proposal to give every Californian a month of basic income from the sale of solar electricity. The first segment of this show, featuring Professor Mulvaney, was recorded on December 1st, 2019. Today we're going to talk about what do we do with a problem like PG&E? We're going to have a conversation about electrical utilities, how they operate, who regulates them and doesn't regulate them, and the future of PG&E and various alternatives. Well, let's get started with the show. Welcome, Dustin. I'm glad you could be here on this rainy day.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with having you tell us about your background, what you do, and how you got into this business.
Well, as you described, I'm a professor at San Jose State, and before that, I spent some time at UC Berkeley doing a postdoc, and before that, I was a graduate student at UC Santa Cruz, where I first met you. And going back in time before that, my first degree was in chemical engineering, and I worked in the chemical industry a little while before going back to graduate school, and I've always been interested in questions around technology and environmental change, and the opportunity presented itself for me to go to graduate school, and that's how I got on this pathway. But I've done a lot of consulting also around energy systems in addition to my academic job. So that's how I've come into contact with PG&E most frequently.
Yeah, so you've done testimony at various kinds of hearings about PG&E, right?
That's correct, yeah.
Just tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So I've worked primarily for the Sierra Club and Earth Justice before the Public Utilities Commission. So because PG&E is a regulated monopoly, when they change their electricity rates, they have to go before the Public Utilities Commission to get those approved. And one thing that we'll do, Sierra Club, will hire an analyst like myself to say, okay, if we change the electricity rates, how does it affect the price of an investment in solar? Does it make it more attractive for people to go solar or not? Same with energy efficiency investments and things. Because if they make electricity too cheap for certain ratepayers, it then doesn't pencil out for them to go solar or invest in energy efficiency.
You know, I'm sure there's a question in everybody's mind, which is, how did we end up with this particular utility system in Northern California? You know, what's the history of PG&E and private utilities more generally?
Well, utilities are a special kind of business because they're thought of as having a natural monopoly, meaning we don't want to have multiple telephone poles running electricity wires competing against each other. So usually the state grants a natural monopoly to an entity that provides natural gas or electricity, and PG&E is just a merger of a whole bunch of previous gas and electric companies that were much smaller, but that's how we're left with really three investor-owned utilities in the state: PG&E, SoCal Edison, and San Diego Gas and Electric.
But there are also private public utilities, right?
There are smaller public utilities, correct. And usually the legacy, these are historical artifacts, usually whether a utility is public or private. In some cases, a private utility or investor-owned utility has existed and some part of that utility has broken away to become a smaller publicly mm-hmm. held ones. But in other parts of the country, there were no investors to invest in public infrastructure. So like the Tennessee Valley Authority is a publicly held utility, but they don't have the same kind of progressive policies you'd see in California in terms of renewable energy adoption and such. So necessarily, the public versus private is a historical artifact as much as anything else.
The whole idea of regulation began during the great era of the great trusts back at the beginning of the 20th century.
That's right, yep.
When private companies were buying up bankrupt small ones to consolidate right. and essentially establish monopoly positions, right?
Yep,
so the progressives across the country imposed state regulations so that these monopolies
That's right.
would be allowed to operate without gouging the public.
Yeah, and it's funny because if you look at the titles of a lot of those companies, they were consolidated so-and-so gas and electric company. It was like literally in the titles of the companies.
How well did this regulation work? I mean, how did it work during the 20th century?
Well, there's a couple of different businesses in electricity, right? So you have people generating power. You have people transmitting it from the generators to where it's going to be distributed. And then you have distribution. And then you have retailing. So you really have four segments. And historically, all four of those things would happen by the same company. They would generate the electricity and they would market it to customers and deliver it all the way to them. And then we decided that markets would be a better solution for what would otherwise be a captive customer base with a monopoly. So they thought maybe utilities were doing things that were not necessarily disingenuous, meaning they would cost electricity too much, make electricity prices go up too much. So in the late 90s, really, there was a conversation about breaking up utilities into these different businesses. And they made, for example, PG&E sell off all of its power plants. So it became kind of more of a transmission and delivery and retail entity than a generator base that it had in the past.
Yeah, except for Diablo Canyon and the hydro power
That's
facilities,
correct.
Right?
Certain
the most
unique,
expensive and the cheapest, right?
Certain unique assets that could not be sold to other entities, yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
One of the things that I remember, I didn't know this, but you know, as a kid, was that electricity was the energy source of the future, that everything would be all electric. Where have you heard that one, folks? Right, because electricity would just get cheaper and cheaper.
That's right.
And as the nuclear folks promised us, it would be too cheap to meter.
That's right.
So so the idea was that utilities would just sell more and more electricity, right? And but in order to keep them from making super profits,
That's right. Yeah.
They were only allowed a certain return every time they came back to the Public Utilities Commission. And this was based on, you know, their plant, the facilities they had built, and a certain amount of money. But
That's right.
But then in California, we had the situation where electricity started to get really expensive,
right.
especially once Diablo Canyon started operating. And I don't remember exactly when that was. Do you?
Diablo Canyon comes on in the 80s.
In the 80s.
In the
was that long ago?
Yeah. No, it's coming on. I'm not sure there's a direct connection with Diablo Canyon necessarily in PG&E's prices, although it's been a very expensive power plant to operate. And, you know, it turns out that it's cheaper to spend a lot of money to close it than it is to keep it running long-term because of the once-through cooling system, which basically entrains a lot of marine wildlife. So same issue we have up here in Monterey Bay with Moss Landing. There's an interesting moment, though, in the time period you're talking about where there's two kind of we talk about this energy deregulation as this thing. Energy deregulation is basically when we wanted to start splitting apart the generators from the people who transmit it, meaning if PG&E did both the generation and the transmission and distribution, maybe it'd be cheaper if we let the market actually figure out cheaper generators and get more power plants from what we call merchant power plants involved. And so The other thing that happens alongside that in parallel, and often why it gets it's confusing to talk about energy deregulation, is this decoupling thing, which you described before, which is decoupling the profits from sales of electricity from the business model, essentially. Because right now you have a business model where electricity is generated and sold, and it's not necessarily in the investor-owned utility's best interest to sell less of it unless there's actually a reward given to them. So decoupling essentially let PG&E sell electricity and make a return when they got people to consume less, or at least kept it steady and made it more easy.
That was the theory.
That was the theory. That was the theory, yeah. Exactly.
As I recall, the theory was that the market, the free market, would basically push electric generators, people with, companies with electric generators, to compete to offer the lowest price to the utility. I mean, that was the theory, right? In competition, they would push the price down.
Right.
But what happened was, because of the way in which utilities require electricity, because of the, the changing demand over the course of the day, mm-hmm. Some of the generators started gaming the system.
That's right. Yep.
And running up costs to an unconscionable level.
Yeah.
And San Diego had no choice but to San Diego Gas and Electric, as I recall, had to pay that, and the retail price of electricity skyrocketed. And this is when those famous California brownouts took place. It wasn't an energy crisis, it was a market crisis.
There were blackouts. They weren't just brownouts. They were actual blackouts, and they affected actually as many customers as were affected by this recent blackouts that we've had over the last couple months with the fire safety precautions. So there we have, energy deregulation means a lot of different things, and that's, I think, one thing we have to be clear about, because some of the early energy deregulationing, allowing a rooftop solar customer to suddenly dump its electricity into the grid, that's a good move in the energy deregulation space by opening the market up to competition. So in that sense, it has worked. And earlier I described decoupling and letting PG&E profit being able to profit without having to sell more electricity. I mean, that's the challenge with the system. You have a fixed amount of generators in the system, and you can't just let you don't have an infinite amount of resources. The particular moment that you're describing, which involved Enron and them scheduling power plants doing maintenance, quote unquote, and actually that just restricted the amount of power that was being generated, and they were swapping power back and forth over the states, so wheeling power around in different markets and marking it up every time they had a transaction, and that really caused a lot of economic damage, and some of those challenges that came out of there, Gray Davis ended up signing some very long-term contracts that were actually very, very high priced. The prices came down pretty shortly thereafter, but California got locked in for 10 years at really high prices for a while. So that experiment of energy deregulation, some would call it a partial deregulation, because even though it's the generator cost, the cost that PG&E was paying for electricity from power plants was skyrocketing, what PG&E could pass through to us was capped as customers, and that's where they went bankrupt, right? Because they weren't allowed to pass on those costs to their customer base. So that had left a pretty big mark, I think, on the state's experiment, and maybe has influenced others to come up with new rules to make sure those kinds of things don't happen, or go the opposite way, which is to have these things be publicly owned.
Well, it leads to two questions. Let's see if I can keep them in mind. The first one is, what does PG&E get rate increases on the basis of these days? If it's not, selling more electricity, building more plants, increasing its the value of its setup. How do they get rate increases?
Well, you mean electricity rate increases?
Electricity, yeah. We're not talking about gas, right?
Well, electricity rate increases would be something that gets approved that helps pay for the system.
Mm-hmm.
That really shouldn't affect their profitability. I think the bigger question is how are these how, Well, go ahead. I'll let you.
No, no. So the rate increases are to address increased costs of operation.
Correct.
Right?
That's right.
And then there's a fixed return on top of
that's
that.
Correct.
Is that how
that's,
it works?
That's how the monopoly works.
Okay,
in
so
California.
That's how it works. And what's the fixed return these days? Do you know?
12%. Someone will have to Google that to which correct it, but it's,
which isn't bad if you're
it's pretty darn good if you're you know, especially talking if you've got tens of billions of dollars of value, although that value's not there right now, and that's where this problem is really thorny now with the current bankruptcy issues. The value's not there.
Yeah. How do utilities buy electricity now? I'm thinking about through the ISO and the bidding process.
Right, right. They buy electricity through different markets. One is, like, for example, the day-ahead market. They'll schedule certain power plants with renewables. They have, because we have a renewable portfolio standard, which requires the utilities to buy an increasing amount of electricity every year. Those are usually long-term contracts. So it's actually pretty messy how electricity is contracted for. And that's part of the complication. So some of it's bought on spot market, like who's available now and what are they selling for? And some of it's contracted long term. So the process is very muddy. There's not a clear cut process because different entities get to play in the market different ways.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Sustainability Now on KSQD FM and ksqd.org, streaming on the internet. Today, we're broadcasting a solar medley of excerpts from past shows on solar energy. The next segment of our show, featuring Fred Keeley, was recorded on November 18th, 2021.
What about the argument that PG&E is as concerned about Wall Street as about its customers?
Well, PG&E, and having worked in the energy crisis, PG&E is a relatively outdated concept. It used to be in the generation, transmission, and distribution business, and it's an outdated concept. This idea that we centrally generate, then push it out onto transmission lines, and then pull it down off the transmission lines through a distribution system, I don't see in 50 years that model exists at all.
Really?
I have a hard time understanding why it would be. PG&E is every day finding itself closer and closer to being in the transmission and distribution business.
Well, yeah.
What a lousy business that is to be in.
Yeah.
You've got, again, 19th century technology in the 21st century, and you at some point are going to have to harden that system, to use your word, harden the system. You're going to have to underground a lot of it. You're going to have to, all kinds of things are going to have to happen that are fabulously expensive capital outlay to go from the 19th century to the 21st century and jump over everything in between. That's going to be fabulously expensive. And there's only one source of payment of that, and that's the ratepayers. It's not like California government's going to do it and somehow not charge taxpayers, or PG&E's going to do it and not charge ratepayers. Their deal is their parent company, Pacific Gas and Electric Company, it owns a series of regulated utilities. It's not just PG&E that we think of as the retail business. Uh-huh. They own lots of the holding company up on top, just like Edison International owns a lot, including Southern California Edison. Those companies are operated as for-profit businesses that don't have a regulated rate of return. They expect every one of their subsidiaries to hit their goal of 9.9% rate of return, but the holding company has no such regulatory limit on how much it can it can earn. So it's not very interested in money-losing businesses, which the retail business is becoming more of a loser every day.
But you know, one of the things that we see is that the PUC, the California Public Utilities Commission, and various other friends of PG&E are struggling mightily to maintain that old, you know, the old model, because of fear of PG&E going bankrupt again, right? And what that might, you know, entail for customers in the states. And you just said that in 50 years this will be gone. So at some point, you know, there's going to be either the state will have to buy the system or the system will collapse.
Well, let me tell you why I'm a big believer in the state of California owning this. First of all, as a matter of principle, I think there are certain things that are not suitable for the profit-making business model.
Yeah.
And I happen to think that water, electricity, a couple of other things really should not necessarily be in the profit model business. Let me give you a quick example. PG&E has the opportunity. They don't have a guarantee to any rate of return. They have an opportunity to earn up to 9.9% rate of return or profit. They also pay about 14% hard costs on taxes. So if you took out 9.9% rate of return and 14% taxes, you're pretty much looking at 23% less business inputs that you have to cover through your rate base. In other words, the state could do it cheaper, a lot cheaper, not just a little bit, a lot cheaper, not because they're better or smarter or whatever. They're probably not. The people at PG&E aren't uneducated or stupid. They are very smart people, but they've got two hard business inputs that the state wouldn't have.
That's interesting.
And so if you can take 23% of the cost out at the very beginning, now you've got some room to say, well, what is our plan then as the state of California for running this system and providing, in the modern era, a 100% renewable system of electricity? Well, if you don't have to achieve 9.9% rate of return, you don't have to pay 14% taxes, you've got a much better business model in terms of how much it's going to cost. It's going to cost consumers a lot going forward, but it's going to cost a lot less, it seems to me, if the state of California owns it. And what I mean by that is some kind of state-created entity.
Yeah,
it's not just turning it over to the current Department of Water Resources, which does a real good job, in my estimation, on what their mission is. But we'd have to create a new entity. But you would keep all the labor contracts. You would keep all the, you know, the component parts, and go into the future with a business that is loaded with less expenses, hard expenses going forward, and a new way, a new business model for them, which embraces the notions of renewable energy, distributed generation, and the transmission and distribution system being a much more modern, effective system. I don't think PG&E can get there from here. It's very the cost side of it is too much for them, I think, in terms of what the ratepayers would be asked to bear. I think there'd be a revolution of taxpayers. So why don't we just anticipate that and get ahead of it? Ratepayers aren't going to be happy about hardening this system and bringing it into the 21st century. But the question becomes, who can do it best at the least expense? And my sense is the state could do it better than PG&E.
Do you know of anybody who is actually thinking about what you just laid out? You know, I have been looking at a lot of the, you know, stuff coming out about solar and electricity. I don't think I've seen anybody really talking about that.
I think even talking about it is politically risky to even talk about it. Right now, if you're the governor and the legislature, you can
complain about PG&E. You can hold them up to be a problem. You can point to the PUC to, you know, get tough with them, or whatever it might be, but you don't own the problem. And going where I'm talking about going, you own the problem. And there's sometimes when you want to own a problem. I don't think that's a bad idea. Government should not run away from every problem that's posed to it.
Yeah, of course, that's been, well, maybe, you know, with the infrastructure initiatives, you know, something like that will happen.
Well, I think it's more possible today than it was last week, thanks to the Congress and the President approving the big infrastructure package. Look, I'm not going to speak poorly of a $1 trillion-plus infrastructure package, but let's get real about it. It's over 10 years, so that's $100 billion a year nationally. The California state budget is $225 billion general fund budget. So nationally, we will be spending less every year, less than half of what California's general fund budget is. We're going to spend half of that spread throughout the nation on infrastructure. I just want to get real about it. It's a big number. It's a big step. I'm very happy about it. But if people think every airport, every roadway, every everything is going to be shiny new in 10 years, you're mistaken. It's not going to be. It's way better than nothing, and it's not a little thing. It's a big thing. I get it. But, again, in California, we typically get a way to think about what California should get is it should get about 10%. If you do it on a per capita, we should get about 10%. Okay, so we're going to get 10% of $1 trillion over 10 years. Well, that's not going to build a new hardened grid in California. It's a contribution towards that, and I'm happy because it's your tax dollars and my federal tax dollars, and we're getting them back in California, and that's a good thing. But in terms of thinking, hey, we're going to have a brand new 21st century distribution and transmission system in California, well, relying on the federal government's just passed infrastructure package is not going to get us there. It's a contribution to it. It's a down payment on it, and that's fine. But if we really want this renewable system, and we do, why wouldn't you want it? It's one of the key features that if we don't do it, we're going to fail in terms of the climate change challenge. There's two things we have to do, and the good news is we know how to do them. Have to change the fuel type in transportation, have to change the fuel type in generating electricity. In our challenge with energy, we're not in that place. It's not that we don't know what to do or how to do it, and we have to invent it, and somebody has to discover it, and then we have to scale it and all that. We absolutely know. The good news is we know what to do, and it's all available. It's all available. And the mythology up to a few years ago that, oh, well, that's really a cute idea about these renewables, but you can't scale them. And more importantly, you have to subsidize them. It's terrible. You have to subsidize them. Well, I guess I would ask those people who think it's terrible to have to do that, if they believe that the cost of the Department of Defense in protecting the oil supply lines from the Mideast to California should be factored into the cost of a gallon of oil. Talk about needing a subsidy. So, but the fact is that things have fundamentally changed in the last 20 years, and California can and will become energy renewable independent. And the issue is who's going to pay. We know who's going to pay for that. If you're called a ratepayer when you look one way, or you're called a taxpayer when you look another way, you're the same person in terms of electricity and energy. And so we are all going to pay for that, and it's going to be, I think the question becomes,
is the technology. It's not whether or not it's scalable and all that. It's going to be, what are the advances in technology that let us do this for the least cost mm-hmm. to the ratepayer / taxpayer? Mm-hmm.
You're listening to Sustainability Now on KSQID FM 90.7 in Santa Cruz and KSQID.org streaming on the internet. Today, we're broadcasting a medley of excerpts from past shows on solar energy as part of Solar Energy Month. The third segment is from a conversation with Ali Detrio on June 6, 2021.
So over the years and over the decades, as technology has continued to evolve and advance, we are now seeing a plethora of different technologies that are available to customers that really weren't available in the 20th century when our electricity system was first being built. And what we're dealing with today is basically a energy system that is wanting to evolve with the technology and provide, you know, customers wanting to be more engaged with their energy usage by buying solar panels or smart thermostats or batteries in their garage, or, you know, schools making these investments, or any type of business really wanting to have greater control over their energy costs. And our regulatory system was not built and constructed with customers being, you know, active consumers. They were envisioned as passive consumers in a one-way flow of electricity from large central generating stations and power plants transmitted through long-distance transmission systems down to the individual customer who would just pay their bill and expect the service, and that was it. Now that we have these two-way power flows, I think it's really introduced a new level of complexity for our regulatory systems, and we are trying to evolve the regulatory system to keep up with the technology, which is a very difficult task for regulators, for the technology providers, and for the utilities who are struggling to figure out what is their role going to be in this evolving paradigm where they're not the only game in town. And so obviously there's a lot of friction that comes with that. And given they have a 100-year history of, you know, basically being the only game in town for providing their essential service, they are not going to easily give that up. I will give a plug to Dennis Kucinich, has a book out, The Division of Light and Power. He is my hometown city of Cleveland former mayor, and he was one of the main leaders at the time that saved Cleveland Public Power and kept Muni Light public for the city of Cleveland. And his book does a really good job of articulating a lot of the different strategies employed by electric utilities in the fossil fuel industry to manipulate governments and regulation to their favor. So over, you know, the course of the decade with them agreeing to be regulated, they have become very well-oiled regulatory machines. And so they do wield a lot of power and influence over the regulatory process that was arguably designed to keep them in check. Nowadays, we sometimes think that the utilities are really the ones writing the regulations, really having a strong influence over them. And so there is a lot of tension in the current system today with how do we grapple with so many new players and technologies, and how do we do that in a way that still best serves the public?
Hmm. Okay. Well, why don't we talk about solar legislation now? And there are two bills that I thought we might be able to talk about. The first is SB 1339 from 2018, and that directed the California PUC to develop plans to commercialize microgrids. The second one was just recently tabled in the state assembly. It's AB 1139, which essentially was trying to reform or revise or change net energy metering plans based on the argument that low-income customers are subsidizing high-income homeowners with rooftop solar systems. So let's start with 1339. What was it meant to do, and what happened with it?
Sure, that's a great question. I will say I had the privilege of being on the ground in Sacramento on SB 1339 back in 2018. It's an achievement I'm very proud of, is helping to pass that bill. And I'll say this, back in 2018, even 2017, when the idea was first really germinated, we were, me and a small group of stakeholders that were focused on microgrids and looking beyond just your passive, you know, unfettered solar production and looking towards how do we get more controlled DERs on the grid, meaning ones that are able to optimize and respond to grid conditions instead of just exporting power back through a traditional net metering process that we have today. And so the CEC, the California Energy Commission, they had done a couple grant programs with microgrids that really showed the promise of these technologies. And so Senator Stern in 2018 agreed to run a bill that was going to direct the California Public Utilities Commission to commercialize microgrids through the development of separate rates and tariffs for microgrids so that we could start having these be adopted by a wider set of customers. And so at the time, we had the Napa Wine Country fires and several others in the state, but we hadn't yet had the Camp Fire of 2018 happen. That was in November. And so really, there was no focus, there was not a big focus on resiliency with 1339. Mm-hmm. It was about commercializing technology and really about how do we modernize solar energy and other distributed energy resources to be more responsive to grid needs. So it really had, resiliency is obviously important, but it really wasn't a main talking point for us as we were lobbying for the bill, which is interesting. So what happened with the bill is it eventually did pass. It was a hard-fought process, but we did get the bill passed and signed into law, which I'm really excited about. The Public Utilities Commission then had a number of other things happen between the time that the bill was passed and the time they actually opened a proceeding to implement the bill. First was the Camp Fire, and that was obviously very devastating. We are all still reeling years later from the effects of that wildfire and so many others. But that wildfire in particular was found to be caused by PG&E negligence in upgrading their infrastructure, and that sent them into bankruptcy at the very beginning of 2019, which also coincided with Gavin Newsom becoming elected governor and coming into office. And so the California Public Utilities Commission had a lot on its plate in trying to deal with the wildfires, deal with the bankruptcy, and we were advocating for a while for them to open the proceeding right away as a response for wildfires and the immense challenges that we had in front of us. And instead, the CPUC did not open the proceeding until end of 2019. I believe it was September or October. And that's when they actually opened the proceeding to implement the bill. Then by that point, we had started, talking about what the scope of the proceeding would look like, what issues we were going to tackle. And then in October is when PG&E instituted the first really widespread PSPS events that caused multi-day outages for great swaths of Northern California. And I know Santa Cruz experienced many of those too. And that really brought the commission into, I think, sharp focus in the media and with the governor's administration and what are we going to do about these blackouts. And we also have hanging over us the specter of Gray Davis, who was famously recalled after the rolling blackouts and the energy crisis back in 2001. Mm-hmm. So the CPUC, using its constitutional authority given to it by the state, expanded the scope of the proceeding to not only implement SB 1339, which is to facilitate the commercialization of microgrids by forming separate rates and tariffs, but they also expanded it to include resiliency strategies. And that was not part of the legislation at all. Nowhere in the final text of that bill is the word resiliency. But the CPUC felt they needed to expand the scope of the proceeding to deal with more than just microgrids. And by doing that, I would argue that they've really hindered a lot of the progress that we have been trying to make on deploying resilient energy systems, because had they just focused on creating the separate rates and tariffs for microgrids that would have incentivized and spurred development of microgrids all over the state to help us with these blackouts, they have instead spent a lot of time focused on the utilities and the things the utilities are doing, not really looking to empower customers. And to this day, we do not actually have a functional microgrid tariff, and it's 2021, we've been at this proceeding for more than 2 years. The CPUC is currently looking to wrap up track three of the proceeding and continue on with a track four. So we're still working at the Public Utilities Commission 2 years since the, you know, opening of the proceeding to actually get a functional microgrid tariff in place.
To wrap up this particular discussion, what happened, what ultimately has happened with that bill and that, you know, directive to commercialize microgrids? I mean, what are the utilities actually doing as a result?
That's a great question. They are in the process of doing several things. One is that the Public Utilities Commission authorized them to utilize temporary diesel generation at substations to mitigate the risk of outages for customers. So that was one of the big decisions of track one that was arguably very controversial and I would say was quite disappointing considering all the other avenues that the commission could have taken. So that was one thing. So now we have lots of mobile temporary diesel generation being stationed at different substations around the state in preparation for outages. Then the PUC opened up a track two of this proceeding to start looking at some of the other issues, truly trying to commercialize microgrids. And they issued a decision with five main topics looking to help ease the regulations for microgrid developers. Though I will say that none of the proposed changes have really borne any fruit to date. And I would say they were largely very administrative and not very impactful in their reach compared to what they could have done. The one thing that is good that's coming out of this, and I'll be interested to see how it plays out, is that the commission, expanding its authority with resiliency strategies, authorized the creation of a microgrid incentive program for in-front-of-the-meter multiple customer microgrids that are serving vulnerable populations. And the goal of this program is to fully fund microgrids in these vulnerable communities that a population would otherwise be unable to afford. So they're looking at funding probably about 15 microgrids across the state with ratepayer dollars, and they're going through a process right now of figuring out what the program criteria should be, how should scoring and the application process be prioritized, and how, you know, how customers can actually get that money. I will say I think it's quite disappointing that the Public Utilities Commission chose to go in that direction versus making a widely available microgrid tariff available to customers immediately so that we could have microgrids be distributed all around the state and have some of that cost be borne by the private sector, who would share in the cost of building microgrids and actually help reduce the cost of the infrastructure for all ratepayers by sharing in that cost.
Mm-hmm.
The incentive program targeted a few specific customers is general, in my opinion, is an inefficient way to distribute limited ratepayer funds. So I will be interested to see what comes out of this process. But I will say we're probably several years away from any of those microgrids being built because multi-customer microgrids are not very prevalent in California due to all the regulations we discussed earlier in the show about, you know, the competitive monopoly on distribution. So we're still several years away from having microgrids under this program actually be built.
You're listening to Sustainability Now on KSQD 90.7 FM in Santa Cruz and ksquid.org, streaming on the internet. This is Solar Energy Month on Sustainability Now, and are broadcasting today a series of excerpts from previous shows focused on solar energy. The last segment of today's show features Bob Staton and was recorded on December 15th, 2019.
My first book, Power Shift, described how the world can transition to 100% solar-powered energy systems and why we should do so. My new book, Solar Dividends, grew out of that first book and provides a new and, I hope, interesting way for how to make that happen.
Provide us then with a general overview of the proposal you're presenting in Solar Dividends.
Sure. My idea is to use solar energy to eliminate poverty. The idea itself is straightforward. We set up solar panels for each person on solar farms, sell the electricity the panels generate, and deliver the money as solar dividends to the person as their basic income. It builds on the idea of unconditional basic incomes, which Andrew Yang, as promoted in his presidential campaign. In such a program, people receive a basic amount of money every month, unconditionally, to keep them out of poverty. This is becoming more important as jobs disappear into robotics and artificial intelligence. But most basic income plans are paid for by raising taxes, and that's where they meet a lot of resistance. Instead, my plan generates a valuable commodity, electricity, and pays for that, and sells that to pay for the program. I think this will be a more acceptable way to generate basic incomes. In my plan, we don't give people solar panels because many people can't use them directly because they don't own their roof and because they move. The panels are instead designed to set up on a permanent location in a cooperative-run solar farm, and the electricity that they generate is sold into the grid. The panels pay for themselves through the money they earn by generating electricity. After payoff, the money becomes the monthly solar dividend. The money itself won't run out because the panels are maintained and replaced as needed. And we don't have to wait for an international treaty to start this program because every country receives enough raw solar energy to set up their own program. So by investing in productive solar panels and adjusting how we price electricity, we can actually generate basic incomes for everyone without new taxes. So eliminating poverty becomes a whole new reason to build a lot of solar. If climate change doesn't motivate you, perhaps providing economic security for your children and grandchildren will. We could call this a poverty prevention program, with an added side benefit of halting climate change. Even climate change deniers could get on board with that. In the future scenario I describe in my book, each newborn is granted a 10-kilowatt array at birth. The panels are installed in their name, but they don't actually own them, just the right to the electricity revenue. The first few years of operation pay off the panels, and then the electricity money goes into a solar escrow account. At age 18, they are given the escrow funds as a lump sum to start their adult life, and the solar revenue starts flowing directly into their bank account as their monthly basic incomes.
Now I want to just turn to the economics of this for a brief moment. So the proposal envisions electric utilities or distributors, I suppose it would be, paying $1 a kilowatt hour for electricity generated by these solar farms. And I read the book and I understand it, but I think our audience probably is wondering how you could get away with that.
Right, sure. It sounds a little shocking when you hear it for the first time, because most electricity costs in the range of 5 to 20, 25 cents per kilowatt hour. So a dollar kilowatt hour sounds pretty outrageous. But keep in mind that the solar dividend, solar farms, becomes only a part of this total electricity supply for the utility, along with many other sources. So I'm proposing that utility regulators require the utility to pay $1 per kilowatt hour only for electricity generated specifically for solar dividends from certified solar dividend farms. And they would do that for the combined social benefits of encouraging renewable energy to halt global warming, reducing poverty by providing basic incomes, and establishing a sustainable and clean energy system that won't run out. Those huge benefits justify the high price. This, of course, would lead to higher electricity prices, but not as high as you think. You won't see a dollar a kilowatt hour on your electric bill. The $1 cost to the utility is only for the part of the electricity supply from solar dividends. That gets rolled into the other sources that are cheaper. Your bill will actually reflect the average of all of the sources. At first, when only a few solar dividend farms are operating, there won't be much effect at all. As more farms are built and more of the electricity supply comes from that source, utility bills will gradually rise. If eventually, say, half the electricity supply costs $1 and half costs 12 cents to the utility, then the average cost on the consumer's bill would only be about 56 cents per kilowatt hour. Now, let's put that in perspective. PG&E's baseline rate is currently 22 cents per kilowatt hour, and it goes up to 49 cents if you use so much that you go into the third tier of pricing. So 56 cents doesn't sound that much higher than 49 cents. And of course, the higher prices will be easier to pay for because you are receiving $1,000 per month in basic income. The solar dividend income is much more than the increase in the electricity cost. Now, that might sound a little circular, but it works because only individuals are eligible for solar dividends, not businesses, governments, or organizations. So they help pay for the program through their utility bills. And as my book explains, higher energy prices are coming anyway. Our current low prices derive from abundant fossil fuels, whose full costs we simply do not pay. No one pays for global warming. So in a sense, we are cheating by paying low prices. We are foisting those high costs onto the next generations. So I think there are so many changes that are coming down that it's hard to say exactly how this will play out. The point, I think, is to establish the basic principles of the program, which is that solar energy has value. That value is spread all over the earth because solar energy is spread all over the earth. And because it is spread out, we can harvest that energy for the general good and for the allow everyone to have a piece of that economic pie, essentially.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So,
you know, my philosophy at this point is that you really have to start with pilot examples and try and do it on a smaller scale.
Well, that's exactly what my book proposes.
Yeah,
I have a whole chapter on,
I think,
yes, in order to make this happen. This is a very new idea. Whenever I present this, people go, wow, that's very interesting, but I've never heard of this before. So I can't give examples of it working, of course.
No.
So, but that's what the goal of a pilot program would be to set it up in a way that we would have solar arrays installed and they would generate electricity. The electricity would be sold into the grid and the money would be used to pay for a basic income for a select group of people. And you would probably start it with low income people, be selective in that regard, because that's where it would have the most impact. But of course, the utility is not going to sign on to that immediately and start paying a dollar a kilowatt hour unless they're being very generous or if they're forced to by the state. But you could simulate it in a pilot program by having another source of funding so that it would look like it's coming from the utility, but it's actually being transferred via blockchain or some other payment process to make it look like it's coming in as the payment for the solar dividends from the utility company. The point would be to study the effect on the people who are receiving the money and to study how much solar is installed and what kind of incentive this would create in the public for seeing these kinds of programs put in place. And I think once once these programs are studied and the benefits are documented, that would give ammunition to advocates and to sympathetic politicians to try an actual pilot program with a utility company, basically asking the regulatory body to set the rate for a small scale and see how it actually works in real life.
Yeah, here, there's a proposal for the California Energy Commission.
You've been listening to a medley of Sustainability Now interviews with solar energy experts in preparation for our conversation with Dr. Ahmed Farouqi on Sunday, January 23rd. Dr. Farouqi, who recently retired from the Battle Group, is an energy economist whose consulting practice encompasses rate design, demand response, distributed energy resources, and a raft of other electricity-related issues. We'll be talking about the pending decision by the California Public Utilities Commission to reduce compensation for rooftop solar and to charge households for access to the state's electricity grid. That's on Sustainability Now, January 23rd from 5 to 6 p.m., right here on KSQD 90.7 FM and KSQD.org, streaming on the internet. As a reminder, shows from the 5 to 6 p.m. Sunday slot are rebroadcast the following Tuesday mornings. If you'd like to listen to previous shows, you can find them at KSQD.org/sustainabilitynow and Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Pocket Casts, amongst other podcast sites. Thanks for listening. And thanks to all the staff and volunteers who make KSQD your community radio station. And so, until next every other Sunday, Sustainability Now.
Here comes the sun. Here comes the sun. I say it's all right.